Later, Glenn Mulcair, who was sent to jail in 2007 for hacking into the phones of Princes William and Harry. Mulcair, whose notebook contained thousands of phone numbers, warns that cutting the money means his silence on the scandal may now change. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Jurors in Cleveland have returned for their second day of deliberations in the trial of a man accused of killing 11 women and keeping their bodies in and around his home. The case of 51-year-old Anthony Soule went to the jury yesterday, 3.5 weeks after testimony began. Soule has pleaded not guilty to an 83-count indictment. He faces the death penalty if convicted. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com. With tools to monitor and protect the online reputations of doctors, lawyers, and business professionals, learn more at Reputation.com.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. I'm sorry to say that we will not be able to do the program we had scheduled here for the first hour. We were going to talk with Carl Lippo. He's an archaeologist at California State University, and we will were to be talking about a book that he's authored that looks at Easter Island and some very different ideas about what the storyline is of Easter Island. I'm sorry we couldn't make contact with him, but we will get that program scheduled for another day, and I think that you'll find it interesting. We hope so. Instead, we'll go to the Focus Archives. We're a program from June. I do want to mention that we will be here live in the second hour, and we'll be looking for your questions on estate planning. A lawyer will be with us. His name is John Elder with a local law firm. But for this first hour, we'll go to the archives, and that means that for the first hour, we'll not be taking calls. For humans, the natural sex ratio is about 105 boys for every 100 girls, meaning that if people are having babies and they do nothing to influence the outcome, that the numbers of boys and girls that are born are roughly the same, slight edge to the boys. The problem is that there are some places around the world where for some time now people have been in a very aggressive way sex selecting their children, favoring boys over girls. One place that's gotten a lot of attention on this is China, where now the ratio of boys to girls is 121 to 100. India, also quite serious, 112 boys for every 100 girls. And this is not just an Asian phenomenon. In Azerbaijan, for example, it's 115 boys for every 100 girls. Georgia, 118. Armenia, 120. In this part of Focus, we'll try to look at this phenomenon, talk about why it has happened and what some of the consequences might be. And our guest for the program is Mara Vistendahl. She is a correspondent for Science. She's based in Beijing. She spent half of the last decade in China, where she's written about a number of subjects. Her writing has also appeared in other places, including Popular Science, Scientific American, Foreign Policy. She's the author of a new book that looks at this issue. The title of the book is Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. Public Affairs is the publisher. She is spending some time in the United States talking about the book and about the issue, and we're very pleased that she could be with us on the program to talk. And Ms. Vistendahl, hello.
Hi, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Just to make the basic point, and maybe at some point we could talk a little bit about the biology here that means that you get slightly more boys. But basically, if the idea is that if people did nothing to influence the outcome, we'd get close to the same numbers. It's not 50-50, but it's pretty close.
It's pretty close, right. Slightly more boys than girls are born in nature, but by the time we reach adulthood, that basically evens out.
Right. And this is something that we certainly have heard about in China and in India, there the numbers are fairly significant, and I gave them. So in China, roughly speaking now, we're looking at about 120, 121 boys for every 100 girls. In India, 112. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, this is not just something that we see in in China and India. But let's maybe first talk about China. Tell us some more about what's happening there.
Sure. And actually, the census results just came out for both China and India.
Mm-hmm.
And the most recent census in China showed 118.
118, okay.
Yeah. That was still a rise over 10 years ago, though. It's very common. You know, if you go to a certain part of eastern China and go to an elementary school, you'll just see many more boys and girls. And it's not so much an issue in the largest cities anymore, in places like Beijing and Shanghai. But if you go to the cities of 1 to 2 million people in the eastern provinces, it's a big problem.
Mm. And what about India? I think it is particularly a problem in northern India.
In the northwest.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And in Delhi in particular, and even in wealthy neighborhoods of Delhi, although the census there also showed that sex selection spread to new states, to places where it never existed before.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that we know that it's something that people are doing, and it's being, we can talk about why they're doing it, but on one level, the reason that they're doing it is because they can, and that access to prenatal testing to determine the sex of the fetus is now pretty common. It's not very expensive, so people have the ability to do it.
Sure, there's been this desire to kind of tinker with nature throughout human nature. I mean, even Aristotle wrote about methods of sex selection. The difference is that we've only recently had the ability to actually control the outcome of a pregnancy.
Mm. And it has gotten some attention in the media, particularly in China, as it is connected to the one-child policy. We've gotten some attention to this in India, but one of the things I think it's really striking about your book is that you spent time not only in China and India looking at this, but some other places as well. And the important point here is that this is not just something that's happening in China and in India.
No, definitely not. Although, I mean, those are the largest countries, so they tend to be the ones that get focused on. But also in South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, you mentioned the Caucasus countries, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and in Albania recently, it's also spread to the Balkans. And in all of those countries, you've seen a kind of a similar trend as in China, where the birth rates declined pretty dramatically, and that's kind of raised the stakes for each birth, and really reduced. There's been this preference for sons, obviously, in all of these places, but now there are fewer chances to get one.
Yeah. Well, this gets us to starting to ask some questions about why is this happening? And I think that probably some people, their ready explanation would be sexism, pure and simple, and that they would say, well, what we're talking about here is places where people value men over women and boys over girls, and that what people say is, you know, if you ask them, well, would you rather have a son or a daughter, people immediately are going to say they would rather have a son. Now, that may in part explain what's going on, but I think what you're arguing here is that there's more to it than that.
There is more to it. I mean, of course, sexism is part of the story, and it is sadly prevalent still in the world today. And it wasn't even that long ago that Americans had showed some preference for boys. That was before sex selection was possible. But it's, you know, that's just there, and it is also happening at a time when, in many ways, women are better off than ever before in the developing world. They are driving the economies. They are going into professional careers, into political careers, and even some of the couples I spoke with talked about the value of daughters and really recognizing that. But at the same time, this desire for at least one son has persisted.
Mm-hmm. And is that, and I think that part of this is a cultural value that says as you get older, who's going to take care of you? It's going to be the sons. Those are the ones that you expect to take care of you. And is that something that's really rooted in reality, or is that just a kind of an idea that people hold and have held for a long time, but it's not maybe as critical as it once was?
That may be changing, right. That is, it may be, it's a reality in some countries where there isn't, especially when there isn't a great social service system to provide for people when they're older. And that's something that's been talked about in China in particular, that the daughters marry out of the family and the son kind of stays with you and takes care of you. But that's changing, as you know, now with urbanization, more old people are left to live on their own. Couples are moving to cities far from their parents. A lot of these things are in flux. But so far, they haven't yet had an effect on the sex ratio at birth.
Mm-hmm. And something else that's interesting and maybe counterintuitive, because people might associate this idea of selecting for sex in that way, something they might associate that with places that are less developed. But the fact is that this trend has persisted even in places where people are doing well. And what you see is that as people's living standards improve and as conditions for women improve, and this is something we see again and again, is that people voluntarily start to limit their family size. Well, that sort of goes hand in hand with this other idea, is that if you're going to have five children, your odds of having a boy are better. But if you're going to have one or two and you really want to have a boy, then maybe you start thinking you have to do something to make sure that you do have that boy.
Sure, it is about people limiting family sizes, and there's also a history of population control, and in several countries where sex selection occurs. I went into that a little bit, but that's a big factor. And even if you look within countries, it sounds paradoxical, but sex selection starts with the educated, with kind of more middle or upper class people, starts in cities. Later spreads to other parts of the country, but still in India, Delhi has a pretty skewed sex ratio at birth, and also the Northwest, which is kind of the breadbasket of the country. So, you know, it's not something that is being done so much in poor rural areas.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Mara Visnadal. She is a journalist. She works for Science, the weekly science publication. She is based in Beijing. She's spending some time now in the United States to talk about the ideas you'll find in her new book. It's titled Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. That's the subtitle. It's published by Public Affairs. And indeed, looks at the fact that there are some places in the world where some time now people have been, in a very aggressive sort of way, sex selecting their children, favoring boys over girls. And the result has been it has upset the natural balance in the numbers of male and female. And she talks about a little bit about why this is and some of the consequences in the book. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk some more about China, the place where you've been living and writing about for some time now. And if you look at life in China, particularly maybe it's more critical in cities where you have more people and maybe the imbalance is even more serious. What are the consequences of the fact that now you have more young men than you do have young women?
Well, so sex selection really took off in China in the 1980s, and the 1990s picked up even more. And so most of this imbalanced generation, they're still young. And that's changing. Now we see sort of the start of this, what demographers called surplus males coming of age. But by the 2020s, it will be a huge problem, and an estimated 15% of men in China will lack a female counterpart in the population. But in other parts of East Asia where sex selection hit earlier, we're already seeing a lot of buying of brides. So men are going to poorer countries like Vietnam to buy women, and they go on these so-called marriage tours, a little bit like mail order bride tours here. And bring home a wife. And sex trafficking is on the rise as well. There are a lot of problems as a result of this huge gap. Mm.
So basically, here the idea is that now you're starting some places. You're starting to see a problem where you have young men who want to get married. There just aren't enough women to go around, just the simple numbers, and that the concern is that if this trend continues into the future, another 10, 15 years, it's going to get much, much worse.
That right. Also, there's the fact that the first generation of men, they might marry younger women, and then for the ones who come of age later on, they just were even worse off. But, of course, it's a huge setback for women who are now more at risk, especially women in poor areas who are more at risk of being bought and sold and kidnapped. I did talk to some of the women who have been transported from poorer countries to wealthy ones as a result of this imbalance, and I think it's very difficult for them.
Mm. So that's not, I suppose that some people could make the argument that would be a, that is, if we do this and not in a criminal fashion, but that might be a viable idea that, well, if you don't have enough women, that maybe the idea is you could recruit women to come from someplace else. I mean, is that really, if assuming that you could eliminate the problems that would be associated with that, is anybody really saying, well, that could be a viable solution?
That's an old idea. You know, even if you look back at America's history, the Wild West, there were reformers who, there was one reformer named Eliza Farnham who tried to organize a ship of women from eastern United States to sail to the West, and didn't work. But no, today there are the Korean and, to a lesser extent, the Taiwanese government have been kind of looking the other way. There were local governments in Korea that at one point even sponsored these tours out of an interest in having the men get married. And today that doesn't happen, but there is, you know, there's not that much attempt to crack down on what's happening. The feminists in East Asia are very critical of this. So it is complicated. On the other hand, Vietnam is losing a lot of women as a result of this, and really the kind of effects of the imbalance are being transferred there.
Mm. Well, we've been talking a little bit about Asia, and again, I think probably as people have read stories about this, they perhaps see it as something that is an Asian issue. I did also mention that you had done some traveling and done some reporting in the Caucasus and some of these places that had been parts of the Soviet Union when there was a Soviet Union. Are people there doing it sex selecting for the same reasons that people do anywhere?
Well, more research needs to be done on the Caucasus countries. I actually went to Albania and not there, where in all of those countries. Sex selection just cropped up recently, and people are just starting to talk about it. The governments are not really acknowledging it. But I spoke with hospital director who said, yes, women are definitely aborting female fetuses, and that it's a big problem here. It does seem to be some of the same issues of the birth rate falling pretty dramatically, also a high abortion rate as in parts of Asia where sex selection is happening. And, of course, a strong desire for sons in the end.
Mm. So you had the opportunity to talk with healthcare workers, and we mentioned a little earlier that the thing is now that the technology is accessible. It's not very expensive. So a woman who is pregnant can go and have a test done and be told whether she's carrying a boy or a girl, and then she can terminate the pregnancy. And that's what's happening here. People are finding out that they're pregnant with girls and they're having abortions. Did you have the opportunity to talk with people who are doing the testing and then providing the abortions and saying to them, don't you realize what a problem here it's a problem now, and if this keeps going, it's going to be an even bigger problem? I mean, what do they say when you say to them, look, you have a big role to play here, and what do you think about that?
Well, I was not so confrontational. I was really just trying to understand why what was happening. But I did talk to both doctors who perform who did ultrasound exams for and determine sex, and also those who refused to, and who were very upset about it. One doctor in South Korea had told me, look, everybody was doing it at the time, and, you know, if I didn't do it, my patients were just going to go elsewhere. Not a great excuse, probably, but that's what he said. And then I spoke with a doctor in Delhi who said, yeah, other doctors, they're just making a lot of money off these tests, and they don't want to give that up. So that's one of the criticisms that's out there.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to suggest that you either you would or you should have been accusatory. That was in the way I formed the question. But the question was whether the people that are performing the tests and then performing abortions, whether they think that that's a problem or whether they're just approaching it as, well, it's a service. We provide it. If people want it, they come and ask for it. We're going to do it.
Mm-hmm. There is a bit of that attitude, but you know, and it is illegal now in both China and India to determine sex. Doctors there are breaking the law.
Yeah. Well,
or ultrasound technicians, it's often technicians of their tests that are performed out of the backs of cars. There are now portable ultrasound machines. One of the problems is that it's very easy to determine sex. So that's an issue.
Well, that again gets at one of the, I think that probably as people have looked at this problem, they have said, well, the one way to solve, other than changing people's attitudes about boys and girls and what you want to have, one of the ways to approach the problem would be to pass a law that said it's illegal to do the test for that reason, to provide people with the information for that reason. And it sounds as if in those places where they've gone that way, that people, there's a demand for the service, so people are going to just go around the law. So if people really want to find out, are they carrying a boy or a girl, there's ways to do it.
Right. Well, yeah, but, you know, the governments have said, we know there's this human desire to want to know, even if it's not for sex selection and not for a sex-selective abortion, but nobody's going to know. And the problem is that the laws are not very well enforced, and there are, you know, the activists in India who are very critical of the government for not cracking down more and not really enforcing this law that's been in place since 1994.
And I suppose that does, as you say, that points to the problem that are you really going to say to all couples who are having babies, whether if they just want to know, is it a boy or a girl, are you really going to say to all them, nope, can't tell you. You won't know until it happens. We can't tell you.
That's what they've said, yeah. And I mean, it's such a great problem, and you know, it's caused and has so many societal after effects that it was decided that was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there, I suppose then if the question comes, this is something you think that you want to do something about, how do you get people from the place where they say, we're going to have a baby, and whether it's a boy or a girl, we're fine with that. We'd be very happy no matter what. How do you get from the point that says, look, we really want to have a son, and that's that, and we're going to do what we can. How do you get people from that point to the other point where people say, we'd be happy either way?
Well, that's something that deserves a lot more attention now. And the United Nations did just come out with a statement on sex selection that had some recommendations last week, and that's an important step. I think there needs to be a lot more study done. There have been programs tried in several countries to pay couples to have girls. There's no evidence that those have worked, but there is also a university in India, in Bangalore, that recently announced it's going to give affirmative action for single daughters. So, you know, we'll reserve some university spots for daughters who have no brothers and, you know, have apparently no sex selection in the family. That, I think, is actually a more promising move, because we're talking about middle and upper class families who, you know, a payment of a few hundred dollars or however much it is not going to make a huge difference for them. But they do care about their children getting into university.
Mm-hmm. Just again, as I mentioned, you've spent now quite a few years, several years at least, living and writing about China. There certainly has been attention paid to the one-child policy. That is, the Chinese, in an effort to slow their population growth, essentially said to all the people in China, you may have one child, and maybe there might be some special circumstances under which people might be allowed to have a second. But basically, the idea is that they're only supposed to have one, which would definitely drive, if it was really important to you to have a son, that's definitely going to drive this, because you'd be saying, well, I've got one chance, so I'm going to do whatever I can to influence having a boy. How much really is this about the one child, at least as far as China is concerned, how much is it really about the one child policy?
Well, that has definitely put more pressure on couples, you know, and it has contributed to lowering the birth rates. But there is some evidence now that couples in China are actually only having one or two children by choice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a group of scholars who've been studying this, and that they're saying now if the policy were to be lifted tomorrow, people wouldn't start suddenly having three or four children. China's become a low-fertility society. And in that sense, people are making the same decisions that they're making elsewhere, that they really only want one or two children, and that policy sort of doesn't matter as much anymore.
Mm. And again, I expect that goes back to just that tendency we see, and I guess you see it everywhere, that as people's circumstances improve, as their economic conditions improve, as people get better educated, particularly as women get better educated, that people have smaller families. That just seems, those things all seem to go together.
Right. Yeah, birth rates do tend to fall as countries develop, and also as women, more women go to work, as more and more girls and women become educated, those all play a role.
This, being in China, I would think that this would be a natural sort of thing that you would want to write about. But is your interest, is it more than just the fact that, well, you're a journalist and you're in China and population issues are going to be a big story? Was that basically the thing that attracted you to spending time on this story?
No, it was really one of these issues that came up in the news from time to time, but I didn't really feel like I understood. I didn't think that it was so well explained. You'd see connected to the one-child policy, but the policy is, you know, more and more irrelevant, not as well enforced as before. And then it also didn't explain why sex selection was occurring in other countries that had no one-child policy. And so I wanted to understand how it could crop up in places as different as China and Albania.
In this hour, Mara Vistendahl is our guest. She's a Beijing-based correspondent for Science. She's also written for Harper, Scientific American, Popular Science, Financial Times. She's spent the last few years in China, where she's reported on a wide range of subjects. And she is the author of a new book that's titled Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. It's published by Public Affairs, and it takes a look at the fact that in some places, in China and India, they've gotten a lot of attention, but other places as well, people are choosing to have boys instead of girls, and it's throwing off what is the natural balance of male and female, starting to be a problem. And I think the concern of a lot of people is that if it continues, it will be an even bigger problem in the future. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm just curious. We mentioned it at the beginning of the program that it's close to 50-50, boys and girls, slight edge to the boys, but not very much. And if the numbers are big enough, it's really not very much. And there is apparently actually a reason why naturally it's going to be slightly more boys than girls. There's a certain point where you can't have more. And I guess I don't know if this is a complicated thing to explain why it is there is the slight, where you get slightly more boys than you do girls.
Well, it's not fully understood, but what is known is that by males die at higher rates throughout their lifetime, so eventually that imbalance sort of evens out. And then that it's also well documented that that's been our sex ratio at birth in many cultures for at least the past few hundred years. And even and Charles Darwin noted that as well. He was very interested in sex ratios and in why they were balanced.
So, well, that's interesting that, that somehow it, it would have worked itself out that way, given that we'll start out with slightly more boys because we're more likely to lose them along the way. So that I guess the idea would be eventually, once you get to the point where people would be reproducing, that it would be closer to 50-50.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically it's balanced by the time we're adults. Yeah.
We have a couple of callers here in Urbana. We'll start out with someone here, line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm interested in your guest comments on the role of religion in this whole process. And I'm thinking in part that, you know, there are parts of the world that are essentially a-religious, like China, where, you know, this phenomenon has taken hold. And there are other parts of the world which are sort of hyper-religious and the role of women and so forth is sort of dictated to by religious practices. So I'd be interested in sort of thinking about how religion plays in, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, is there some way that religion plays into this?
Well, religion doesn't seem to have an effect on whether couples select for sex. And there are, of course, religious traditions that encourage, they dictate, you know, having a son for one reason or another, but it doesn't seem to have an effect. You see this happening in Christian areas, among Hindus, among Muslims. In China, actually, the Christianity is growing, and I spoke with Christian families who had aborted female fetuses. It doesn't seem to have a significant effect, which is surprising. It's something that sociologists didn't really expect.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. This is line number two. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I had a question for the about the subject. It seems like in a lot of areas of life, we're seeing we're limited less and less by what used to be natural laws, and more science is, you know, and technology are taking over and letting us do things we couldn't do before, and we need to, I mean, and we're having to learn how to deal with that. And I wonder if, you know, if you see any signs of this being part of that process, of people have this new ability. And, you know, one of the natural results, if there is a shortage of women, is that women would become more valuable in some sense. And I wonder if you see any people realizing that and adapting and changing their decisions based on choice rather than what they've been driven to by nature in the past. And do you think in the long run it will balance out, or do you have any long-term view of it?
Well, I agree this is one of the ways in which technology is just changing what it means to reproduce. And sex selection is not just happening through abortion. It's also possible during in vitro fertilization and through something called the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which happens at the embryo stage. And it's basically screening embryos for sex. And that's happening in the U.S. and with very lenient regulations. And there are people who are calling for more stringent regulations, or at least a big bioethical discussion about what it means to be able to choose, even before pregnancy begins. And on the other hand, whether this argument that as women become scarce, they also become more valuable, that is, you know, economists like to say that, but it just isn't true. It may apply to a smaller group of women in cities who are born into these high sex ratio areas, but there are also so many women who are at risk of being kidnapped or bought and sold, and they've become more valuable in a way, but people are trying to control that value. So people, you know, parents I spoke with, demographers, everybody recognizes that this is a big problem, but nobody wants to be the first one to act to, you know, kind of take a step toward solving it.
Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Does it, caller?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I view this as an ongoing process of learning how to deal with the technology that we've created, and I'm just curious where we're going and what people think. And actually, what you said is a little frightening about the value of women not being in their own hands, and that's a really good point.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Let's go on. We have someone else here, someone on a cell phone. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm very curious and wondered if you could speak to the impact of infertile couples in the United States, for example, who adopt Chinese girls or girls from other countries, and if that's something that you mentioned in your book and what that impact looks like. Is that just a fraction, or is that something that other countries are considering?
Well, the number of adoptions going out of China has really decreased. I think the reasons for that are complicated. I think one is the birth rate falling naturally and couples just having fewer pregnancies. The other is that the government's kind of cracking down on adoptions and made them more difficult. That's not something I go into so much because even at their peak, we were looking at, I think, thousands of babies adopted out to the U.S., and mostly girls. But now the rate at which sex selective abortion is happening is in the millions. So it is, you know, it's...
So it sounds like, at least as far as this imbalance, this male-female imbalance is concerned, that the numbers of girl babies who might have been adopted out of China was so small that it really wouldn't have affected the balance nearly as much as this very large deliberate thing that people are doing with terminating pregnancy.
Right, and it's not happening, and adoption's just not occurring on the same scale today. Yeah, yeah. I can't speak for how many babies are still abandoned, but I do think it has decreased.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank the callers. Others are certainly welcome. We have time here, about 10, 12 minutes left, with our guest, Maura Vistendahl. Her book is Unnatural Selection. Something here that we haven't yet touched on that I think is particularly interesting is that for a long time, or at least go back to maybe the 60s, the 70s, there was real concern about the problem of population around the world, particularly in the developing world, and mm-hmm. that people who thought about this, and people have thought about it in the West, in the United States and Europe, said that it's going to really be important for countries like China, for example, to limit the growth of their population, limit the numbers of children that people are having, or else they're going to have a real serious problem. And apparently there are some people who actually made this argument that there was no problem with sex selection, that was an important tool in controlling population, making this argument that said, well, if people really want a son, this way they can get it, and they won't have to keep having children until they finally get that boy if they can have the boy first time out. So there's this unintended way in which a real concern about population control has contributed to this problem.
Oh, definitely. This is against the backdrop of all kinds of other very unfortunate supposed solutions to the population issue being proposed, and some of them included coercion, included birth permits, or what would have looked like the one-child policy in China, forced sterilizations in some countries happening, and then the idea to push along research into sex determination came up, and that was happening for other reasons, but that had the appeal to the people who were looking at it as being voluntary, and they talked about it with a lot of enthusiasm, actually. Paul Ehrlich mentioned it in The Population Bomb, the kind of blockbuster book of 1968. There were a number of other people who wrote about it who said, this is a great solution. We need to find a way to guarantee couples boys.
Mm-hmm. So Western organizations that were interested and perhaps for the for good reasons, were interested in trying to promote population control, family planning, actually ended up promoting policies that helped make this might have happened anyway, but it sounds like they promoted policies that actually made the problem worse.
Right. I do think there are legitimate reasons for being worried about population growth, but in general, the strategies that organizations in the West are trying, and these came from both the right and the left, there was a very broad coalition with a lot of support, and they were horrible. And sex selection, you know, it was a time when women had a very small role in this movement. People from the developing world also had very little voice. And one of the things that is, I think, sad is that the people who were proposing these sex selection actually foresaw some of the consequences. So there was a microbiologist named John Postgate who wrote an article for New Scientist in 1973, and he said, you know, this may result in women being not being able to work, not being able to travel as much, and kind of being kept under lock and key. And the status of women will really decline as they become scarce. But overpopulation is such an important issue that we really need to go ahead with this.
Hmm. So when you look at people, say you have people who are living in India, China, wherever, if this is a fairly common practice, if they relocate, say they go to the United States or they go to Europe or they go to some other country where it's not the practice, what happens? Do they bring their attitudes with them, and do they still think in that same way when they get around to having children?
I don't know. Yeah, you know, I don't know how much it's about attitudes or just these trends and you know, pressures in terms of birth rate falling and abortion being widely used. And yes, it is true that among Asian, Korean, and Indian Americans in the U.S., there have been skewed sex ratios found for later births. I mean, that's a sign also that the things like the one-child policy don't they're not the only cause.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with him in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? I've read reviews of your book and your literature. I think I've heard you on other programs. But this is an interesting example of cumulative actions of individuals causing major social problems down the road. And I think I remember someone was discussing your book somewhere or had written an article about it and talked about in some of these villages in India and in China, the ratio is actually 150 to 100, you know, like 150 males to 100 women, and if you were to look at it numerically. But you're right also to keep the economists out of this because they don't really know much about how to value someone. It's very interesting. But I wanted to ask you, is this going to have a self-corrective down the road? And will women become more prostituted because of this? You know, like, for instance, all these young guys running around in these cities in China, these new, you know, megapolises or whatever you want to call them, going to be running around with no girls. I mean, what's going to happen to that? I mean, you know, this sexual drive of a young man is supposedly needs to be sated. But could you discuss that? I don't know if you've already discussed that. I came in this late. But I really, your work is really important. But it's sort of not important to the Western world, I don't think. I think we sort of observe this stuff. But do you think there'll be a corrective down the road in that people will go, uh-oh, you know, my son has nobody to marry? Thank you very much.
Right.
I appreciate
your
work. Yeah, bye.
There is evidence that prostitution has increased as a result of the sex ratio imbalance, at least in China. There's just one study that's been done on that. And, you know, I mentioned sex trafficking earlier in the show. The U.S. State Department lists the sex ratio imbalance as a major cause of trafficking in Asia now. And women are mostly being trafficked as into marriage and into forced marriages, but also as prostitutes. Demographers don't believe this will be around forever, that instead it seems to be something that just lasts for
late, 20, 30 years. South Korea, the sex ratio at birth is now balanced after a few decades of sex selection. But how exactly that comes about, that's still something that needs to be studied a bit more. It can be encouraged, I think, through policy measures and through also efforts to look at people's attitudes and some of the other factors that are underlying this. I do hope that it will sort of correct itself eventually, but we need to look at ways to push that along.
Well, it certainly would seem that it would not be that the trend here is pretty obvious. You can already see it. And that you don't need a supercomputer to run this out into the future to see what will happen. So it would seem that it would not be that difficult to see it, that it was a problem, understand why it was a problem, and then from that, then maybe solving the problem is more difficult, but at least acknowledging that it was a problem and that something that you needed to do something about, that shouldn't be all that tough.
No, and governments in Asia are worried, and it's not their first priority. There definitely needs to be more international action. At the individual level, parents, it's very obvious. Everybody knows about it. Everybody talks about it. But it's a little bit like environmental protection here. Like, we know we need to do something about the environment. We know we need to consume less and use less, but when it comes to giving up your SUV or, making difficult decisions for your own family, I think you don't want to be the first person to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little bit like that. Like, people want other couples to have girls.
Is there some way in which maybe people in the West are not inclined to talk about this, or it becomes more difficult to talk about because you end up having to talk at some point about abortion?
Mm-hmm.
And the people, particularly people in the West who believe in the right to choose, don't want to talk about this because it maybe cast some sort of aspersion on abortion, or you want to say, well, this is a problem, but at the same time, you want to continue to say that a woman should have that choice.
It is a difficult thing to talk about in the West for that very reason, and that is apparently one of the reasons that the United Nations has been slow to act on, just slow to really take a stance on sex selection. There has been a lot of research done at the local level and funding of efforts at the local level, but until this statement that came out last week, there hasn't been so much of kind of international consensus on what needs to happen, because it gets into abortion politics.
Well, we talked about the fact that some governments have said one way that they've tried to approach it is by making it illegal for someone, for a doctor, some healthcare provider, to make it illegal for them to tell people the sex of the child that they're going to have, which seems kind of rash in a sense that, why shouldn't people know? But there are some places that said, well, you can't do that. So maybe that might be one way to approach this. You talked about something else, that maybe what governments could do would be to put some kind of policy in place that would actually reward people for having girls, or at least say that girls would have certain kinds of advantages. So maybe you would have a reason for thinking it would not be a bad thing to have a daughter. Aside from that, though, what are people thinking about doing to change this?
Well, there are all sorts of measures that have been tried. I think now we need to really look at what's working and what isn't working. There's some evidence that when you actually crack down on sex determination tests, that the sex ratio at birth does become less skewed.
Mm-hmm.
Those laws just aren't enforced very well. The UN recommendations also call for much more, kind of general societal efforts at improving the status of women and changing laws so that they, changing inheritance laws and kind of getting, looking at this as a chance to get rid of sexist
legal restrictions in the culture. And that's probably that's something that's important as well, but there needs to be just, you know, we need to come at it from all fronts.
Hmm. Just one thing, it's kind of interesting that you talk about right at the end, is that for people in the United States, you know, there are various kind of technologies that can influence the outcome. And we're doing all sorts of things to help people have babies. And we don't, I guess, also, though, have real good information here truly on whether Americans have preference or not. But it does seem to be at least in some kinds of procedures that are being done when people have the choice between implanting and carrying on a pregnancy with a girl or a boy, they're actually choosing girls.
That's what the directors of fertility clinics here say. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think it's so different. I think from selecting for boys in Asia, I think there's still this underlying assumption that you're going to shape your child to your whims or to, you know, kind of foist expectations on mm-hmm. on the child. And whatever your reason, you may want to dress your daughter in pink dresses, and she may not want that. I do think that we need to look at these different methods together and really consider what this means. Mm-hmm. The question is not going to go away. In fact, I think we'll soon be able to select for other traits.
Yeah, it's all part of this much bigger picture that says that do you really want to get to a point where you can go into some kind of a clinic and with a checklist and say, this is what I want. This, you know, I want a girl who has blonde hair and blue eyes and is going to be a star volleyball player and a concert violinist and this and that and the other thing. You know, do you, if you get to that point where such a thing is possible, do you actually really want to do that?
Right, a kind of Gattaca situation.
Yeah, yes, exactly so, exactly so. Right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. It's a very interesting subject, and again, the book is titled Unnatural Selection. The subtitle, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. Public Affairs is the publisher. Our guest, Mara Vistendahl, is Beijing-based correspondent for Science, and she's spending some time in the United States talking about the book right now. And Ms. Vistendahl, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, an interview that we first presented on June 24th. Many past programs are available for you to listen to anytime that you're ready. So if there's something that you have missed, you'd like to get caught up, you can go to our website. That way you can also find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead. That's WILL.illinois.edu. And we will reschedule the program that we were going to do this morning. We were planning on talking with Carl Lippo. He's an archaeologist at California State University. We will talk with him sometime, I hope in the next couple of weeks, about his book, The Statues That Walked, Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn offers programs designed to support residents' health and independence and to help them feel secure in their environment. More information is available at 384-0100. Agricultural programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
In the second hour of the program today, we'll be talking about estate planning. We hope we'll get some questions. We'll certainly be open to your questions. The guest for the second hour will be John Elder. He is an attorney here in our area. So that's what we have for you, hour number two. Right now, we'll take our usual break for an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
At a minute before 11 o'clock with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers in for Dave Dickey. A little profit-taking and news of slightly better weather bringing the corn market down a little bit on this Thursday, the wheat following the corn as well. Soybeans are rather mixed to turning a little upward on the deferred contracts. September Kansas City wheat right now is down 16 cents a bushel at 778. The December off 15.5 at 801.5. September wheat on the Chicago Board of Trade down 14 and a quarter cents at 682 and three quarters. D-Sweet wheat 7.23, down 12.25 cents. September corn is right now trading at 6.78 3/4, down 9.25. December 6.71 1/2, down 6.25. March wheat 6.84, down 5.75. March corn, rather, the May corn contract 6.90 1/4, down 6.25 cents. Crude oil for September still hovering around just under a dollar, $100 a barrel, up $1.23 at $99.63 right now. August soybeans up a half penny at the moment at $13.78 3/4. September unchanged at $13.79. November up a penny and a half, now up 2 cents at $13.86. January $13.95, up 1 3/4. In the products, August soybean meal is down $2 at $3.59.90.